In our Sunday evening series of messages on battling those besetting sins that just seem to plague us and never leave us alone, I've referred to a 17th century pastor by the name of John Bunyan. John Bunyan was a Baptist pastor and an independent, which meant he wasn't aligned with the liturgy or theology of the Church of England. His preaching, however, was biblical and sound and fruitful. In fact, so much so the Church of England didn't quite know how to shut him up. And eventually, not just because of Bunyan, but others, there eventually was the successful legislation under the signature of the king that any unlicensed man was forbidden to hold a private meeting with more than five people in attendance. Of course, that was just the choking off of evangelical worship services that were meeting in homes. And John Bunyan refused to stop preaching. He was arrested. In fact, over the course of much of his life, adult life, he would spend much of it in jail. On one occasion, a magistrate was sympathetic to him, wanted to return him to his wife and four children, one of whom was born blind, and wanted to release him. And Bunyan, in that trial, made that rather famous statement delivered there when he said, "If you release me today, I shall preach tomorrow." Even in jail, he began preaching in the courtyard on the Lord's Day, gathered quite a number of inmates around him, but hundreds of people from Bedford, England would come as well to the prison compound and stand around the fence and listen as Bunyan expounded the scriptures. So the officials in the prison finally silenced him by moving him into the inner recesses of the jail in isolation. But there in solitude and silence, John Bunyan would end up speaking louder and further than he could have ever imagined. For in the inner recesses of that prison, he would write an analogy, a metaphor, an allegory about how the gospel of Christ had impacted the life of a young man named Christian who leaves his city and journeys to the celestial city. This allegory we know as the Pilgrim's Progress. It would sell like wildfire. As he cataloged the adversities and the trials and the missteps and the mistakes of this pilgrim. I'm quite convinced if you had the opportunity to interview John Bunyan about his true passion, he would say it was to pastor and to preach, not to write a book from prison. Yet, that writing would exceed any sermon he ever preached in its reach, touching the lives of millions of people. In fact, for centuries now, Pilgrim's Progress has been as widely read and the most widely translated book, second only to the Bible. But I'm sure if you could have asked John Bunyan at different stages of his life how things were going, he probably would have said something like, "They're not really going all that well at all." In fact, there doesn't seem to be much forward progress. During one of his incarcerations, his wife died, leaving him with his four children. He would eventually marry again, and his wife would write in a letter to a friend that they had, quote, "neither a bowl nor a spoon between them." Only near the end of his life did Bunyan realize that his greatest contribution to the gospel would not come from his preaching, but his writing of this little book. It would be published in two parts, the second part published just 4 years before he died. The same lesson is true for us all. It's going to take a longer perspective to evaluate what God has been doing in every one of our lives, to come to some kind of positive understanding of these reversals, those times when we seem to be going backward instead of moving forward, and we can't exactly figure out why, to trust our Lord that even though reversals don't always have an explanation, every reversal has a reason. Which means Christianity involves one of the greatest challenges of all, for all of us, the renewing of our minds so that we learn to view the changes in our circumstances as part of God's divine curriculum. And if you've lived long enough in the faith, as many of you have, you've discovered that God often moves you forward by going in reverse. God often moves us forward in reverse. Which means, as odd as it may sound, that we as believers need to learn how to reverse our thinking in order to correctly interpret the forward-moving circumstances of life as God rolls them out. God often moves us forward in reverse. It's exactly the perspective of the Apostle Paul, who is communicating by way of letter to the believers living in Philippi. In Philippians chapter 1, if you have your New Testament, this next paragraph we arrive at, beginning at verse 12, opens with Paul's reversed thinking, which is good thinking. Let's explore these next few verses together, and I think you'll understand what I mean when I talk about moving forward, even though it seems like we're in reverse. Let me just read the paragraph, verse 12. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. What a wonderful perspective on life. Paul turns everything around as he interprets three different issues that would have brought most of us to some point of discouragement. In fact, let me rephrase as we work back through this paragraph what Paul has written with my own three statements to highlight how he is reinterpreting the events of life. The first statement I want to make is this, as I paraphrase what Paul is writing. I have suffered setbacks and the gospel is advancing. Those elements seem contradictory, don't they? I have suffered setbacks and the gospel is advancing. He says something similar to the Corinthian believers, where he says, I have this open door to me of effective service, and there are many adversaries. Now, wait a second. It's one or the other, isn't it? Not to him. In 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 9, Paul knows that he is reversing the normal way of interpreting the circumstances of life. So here to the Philippians, Paul does and begins in this manner. Now, he begins, if you go back to verse 12, by saying, just look again at that first phrase, I want you to know, brothers. Now, to the Greek reader, that immediately puts you on notice. This was a common expression in Paul's day to call people to pay attention to something that was going to be surprising, something that would be perhaps difficult to understand. So in our contemporary vocabulary, Paul is effectively saying, now I'm going to tell you something that's going to be a little hard to believe. I'm going to tell you something that's going to be hard to buy into, so stay alert, stay with me. Now notice what he says. What has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. I have suffered setbacks. This is what's happened to me, but the gospel has advanced. Now, Paul could have stopped here and written a volume on those things that happened to him. You notice that? But he doesn't do it here, more than likely because the Philippian church had been supporting him faithfully and praying for him, and they already knew the events of his life that would have been calculated as reversals. But for our sake, let me just quickly rehearse what Paul is referring to. For the sake of time, we won't go back, but in Acts chapter 21, it sort of starts where he travels to Jerusalem and at great risk to his own life, and sure enough, he causes a riot in the temple. He's arrested and thrown into jail. In Acts chapter 23, he's finally granted a trial. We're informed, however, that a plot rises against him. 40 Jewish men bind themselves to an oath that none of them will eat or drink again until Paul is dead. Paul's nephew overhears the plot, comes to Paul, delivers it. Paul sends him to the official to deliver the news. So 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, 200 spearmen sort of gather around Paul and they spirit him away at 9 p.m. that night to another city. In chapter 24, he finally is allowed to stand trial, but the official who has the power to release him requires of him a bribe. Paul refuses to pay the bribe, and as a result, he spends 2 years in prison. Another official comes along who can also let him out, but because he sees that it's doing the Jews a favor and he wants his ratings to go up, he keeps Paul in prison. Finally, Paul stands before an official and appeals to Caesar, and so in chapter 28, he's allowed to head to Rome. He boards a ship and with the others, and it heads out to sea, and a northeasterly rises up out of nowhere. It's obvious they're going to shipwreck, which they do, and all of them swim to shore safely on this little island called Malta. These water-drenched people make it to the coast, and the villagers see what's happening. They make a fire. Paul helps out, brings some firewood. A serpent comes out of the firewood and bites him. People expect him to fall down dead. He doesn't die, but he lives, by the way. We often forget with the pain of that bite, that scar. After all this time, after all these events, he says, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really worn me out. What has happened to me has really made me frustrated. I mean, if this is God's way to build his church, it's one setback after another. No, what does he say? I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has served to advance the gospel. I have suffered setbacks, and the gospel is advancing. Let me make one more quick comment. He's not speaking with this, pietism because he knows we're going to be, studying his letter in church one day and he wants to look good. I know it'd be better if I said this. He means it. He means it. He only briefly alludes to the trouble. In fact, he uses a word that really sort of sums up the difficulty. He uses this word advance. It says, really serve to advance. Prakape is the word. It means literally to cut through the brush. Just picture somebody in, the jungle hacking his way through the underbrush, in great difficulty and danger to forge a path. That's the word he uses here. I could see, when I study that Greek word, I could just see Hudson Taylor. We often overlook the difficulty and challenge of this man who there on the coast, on the borders of China, is sitting at a desk in an upper floor apartment. The temperature is well over 100 degrees, and he sits there translating, writing with one hand, while in the other hand he holds a towel as he wipes the sweat that continually runs down his cheeks and drips off his chin. For hours, 10 hours a day. The gospel is advancing. Have you found the Christian experience to be easy? Or is it like hacking through underbrush? Notice, he writes next in verse 13, it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. Paul effectively writes, the whole imperial guard is actually hearing from me about the gospel of Jesus. Let me paraphrase this second statement to highlight his perspective. Here's what he's saying. I have suffered setbacks, and the gospel is advancing. And now he's saying, I am under military guard, and they are my captive audience. Isn't that great? I love it. I am under house arrest, and these guards can't go anywhere. They are my captive audience. Paul isn't exaggerating. He writes here that the entire imperial guard has gotten the message of Christ. Let me tell you what this means. It's staggering. Their name in Latin, which was the official language of the Roman Empire, was the Praetorium. It's not a reference to a building, a palace. It's a reference to people. this elite guard. They were stationed throughout the empire to squash rebellion. Caesar effectively purchased their loyalty, but he did choose them. In fact, Augustus was the first to enlist these men and create the Praetorian Guard. They were the only military expedition or force allowed inside the capital city. Their chief role was ultimately to protect the emperor and the imperial family. Hand chosen by Augustus until he reached 10,000 troops. He paid them double pay. In today's economy, each of these men would have made somewhere between $90,000 and $100,000 a year in today's economy. They would serve for anywhere from 12 to 16 years. And when they retired, they were automatically honored for their faithful service with Roman citizenship, which was highly valued with many benefits. And Caesar gave each of them a pension, totaling in today's economy nearly $1 million. They would eventually become known as the Kingmakers. That would be their nickname. Because no Caesar could ever assume the throne without their approval and their protection. These crack troops had earned the respect of their countrymen. Loyal, hardworking, well-trained, skilled soldiers. Listen, in the strategy of advancing the gospel, God knew that the Praetorian Guard would make outstanding ambassadors and missionaries. We know from other passages that Paul was allowed his own private quarters where members of the Praetorian Guard rotated shifts in guarding him. But get this, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Paul would be handcuffed with one hand and an 18-inch chain, with that Greek term, we know that's about how long it was, to this Praetorian Guard. Every 6 hours, the shift changed, giving Paul 4 soldiers every day, 7 days a week. I mean, his attitude was, bring them on, they can't go anywhere, they're handcuffed. And for 6 hours, I get to deliver to them the gospel. Paul didn't complain about his chains. He consecrated his chains to God. What are your chains? Consecrate them. Whatever that is, that reversal that ties you down. That's how you move forward. In reverse. Not any onlooker, you're going in the wrong direction. But because of your trust in the character of God and the curriculum God has designed for your life, you actually make forward progress. And Paul got it. He interprets his house arrest as a setting where soldiers cannot escape. I love this man. Not an obstacle, it's an opportunity in real life. Like my father, still a missionary today to the military, having founded missions to military. When he called me this morning, he said, so what are you preaching? And I said, this text. And I knew this is one of his favorite texts. He reminded me this is the first military ministry movement in the history of the church. An incredibly fruitful field. Paul is going to deliver the gospel of Christ to these elite troops who shuttled into his apartment every 6 hours. Beloved, this means that Paul will have the opportunity when it's over to deliver the gospel to over 3,000 soldiers at Rome's expense. They sent him a new soldier every 6 hours. Elite troops. We don't know how many of them were saved, but we know when we get to the end of Philippians, Paul says, oh, by the way, members of Caesar's household want to tell you hello. Believers. Now, Paul adds this phrase in verse 13, not just the Praetorian Guard, but notice all the rest, he says. Who are they? Well, we would understand this process that will ultimately lead to the death of Paul. his execution. This would have involved government officials and attorneys who are presenting the government case against him. This would have involved Jewish scholars who are coming in to evaluate these doctrines to determine whether or not this sect is dangerous to Judaism and how it would relate to the Roman government. In other words, on the budget of the Roman Empire, all of these officials, all of these high-ranking men are basically forced to study the doctrines of Christianity under the teaching and tutelage of the Apostle Paul. Moving forward in reverse. I am under military guard, and they are all my captive audience. I have suffered adversity, and the gospel is advancing. One more paraphrase from this text. Paul effectively says, I am imprisoned so other believers can experience freedom. Notice verse 14. And most of the brothers, this is a generic term, you could render it brothers and sisters, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. By the way, that word to speak isn't referring to a sermon. It isn't referring to some elder getting up and delivering some message. This is a word that refers to everyday normal conversation. The brothers and the sisters, when they see me in prison, are emboldened in their everyday conversation to talk about Jesus Christ. The implication here from Paul is that these believers, and understandably so, had been fearful, even reluctant to share their faith. There is a growing hostility. Jewish leaders are intensifying their opposition to those who belong to the way, as it was earlier called. The unbelieving world is beginning to see Christianity as a threat to the loyalties of Rome. They're refusing to offer that pinch of incense to Caesar once a year, and that's rubbing them the wrong way. Ultimately, it will bring about great persecution, and thousands of Christians will die. Paul says, I'm in prison. And it's infusing the believer with courage as they see how I'm trusting Christ. See how God is opening opportunities through adversity for the gospel. Listen, what he's saying or implying is that fear is contagious, but so is courage. You ever been around a courageous person? What does it do to you? Well, it makes you put them in the front of the line, of course, but you're willing to follow. Let me add this. Unfaithful living in the church among believers is contagious. But so is faithful living. Contagious. He's saying here, faithfulness to Christ in the midst of this reversal has become contagious. And I can't help but ask us, which particular germ are we spreading? I am imprisoned, and my brothers and sisters now experience new freedom. What a way to reinterpret the events of life. So that God is ultimately glorified and trusted, and the faith of others is deepened as the truth is communicated, and the Lord is advanced in his glory. As I review the circumstances from Paul's life in the latter chapters of the book of Acts that I rehearsed for you fairly quickly and earlier, I read about how he had this doomed voyage from Fairhaven, the voyage that eventually shipwrecked them all on the island of Malta. They set out from Fairhaven, and it reminded me of something that happened nearly 11 years ago, where I made some forward motion by way of reverse, and it took place in Fairfield, New Haven area. The only difference was I didn't have a good attitude about it until it was over. Perhaps you can identify more with me than the Apostle Paul, but we can learn together. My wife and I, and our younger daughter, who at the time was about 10 or 11 years of old, of age. We were traveling in our van coming back from being out of town, and it was raining. We're on the interstate. It wasn't hard rain, just misty, sort of, but everything was wet. And I wasn't really concentrating as I was driving along, didn't really have a good grip on the steering wheel, and I hit a puddle on the interstate, and it jerked me left, and I overcompensated and pulled the wheel right and just put us into a spin as if we were on ice. We went off the interstate backwards into the grassy slope, and we crashed into the guardrail going sideways, and we just went parallel with that guardrail, knocking one pylon down after another until finally, with all four blown tires, we ground to a halt. We sat there, stunned. My daughter, in the back, took off her earphones and said, "What happened?" So she has no scars from that moment. Marcia and I are still in counseling. But at any rate, we got help, got pulled out. And God had planned for us to go through that without a scratch on us physically, but our van was completely, completely totaled. I visited a dealer in town to find another one like it. It's a conversion, a minivan. They don't even make them anymore. And the sticker shock just sort of gave me a bigger heart attack than that accident. And I thought, wow, has the price ever gone up over the years? And so I went online, and I found the exact van, just like ours, but it was located in Connecticut. I searched the history through the VIN number, saw that it was clean, low mileage, one owner. I called the dealer, negotiated over the phone with the price, and agreed to buy the van. Wayne Witt, one of our elders, was building his air miles as an amateur pilot, and he and another young man from the church flew me in their little plane to Cheshire, Connecticut. Cheshire. The fact that it was named after a cat should have given me my first clue this is going to be trouble. Big trouble. The salesman met us at that little airport where we inspected the van. Wayne and Drew got on the plane, flew back, and I drove with the dealer to the dealership. My plan was to wrap up the deal and to get on the road to make it to my parents' home in Virginia by about 10 o'clock that night. I pulled away from the dealer at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Everything signed. Everything was working perfectly. I drove the van about 20 minutes south and then pulled over at a rest stop, a services exit, to get some really strong coffee and some of those little chocolate-covered donuts that are filled with fiber and vitamins and protein. You know the kind I'm talking about. And anyway, when I went back to the van, I turned the ignition, and nothing happened. Nothing happened, except this strange sound. Now, you're like me. You've driven a lot. You got your own car story, and you've heard sounds. You know the click, 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 click of a dead battery. It wasn't that sound. It wasn't the sound of a bad starter. It was this strange sound. So I got my cell phone out, pulled up the dealer's number, and I called him, and the first thing I said to him was, "What did you sell me?" Only my pitch was much higher. And he said, "What do you mean?" I said, "It will not start. I'm only 20 minutes away. What did you sell me?" He said, "Stephen, we went through the search together. On the computer, it's had one owner. It's got low miles. In fact, we found that the only thing that was ever wrong with it was it needed a new headlamp and one of the locks on one of the doors malfunctioned. That's it. This thing is clean." He said, "You do have roadside assistance for free because it's under warranty." I thought, "Well, that's thrilling. I'll use it." So I waited for 2 hours. The wrecker finally came, towed me to a little town nearby, the town of Fairfield, Connecticut, near New Haven. Fairfield. It was not fair, and there were no fields. Think of downtown Cary, just a little village, little town. When we got to the dealership, it was after 5 o'clock, and it was closing. One of the mechanics told me, "Look, I'll take a look at it," and he did. He checked. He said, "It's strange. It's got gas, spark. It's got good battery. It's getting gas. I don't know what's wrong with it. Tell you what I'll do is I'll come in tomorrow morning and first thing I'll take a look at it. And I said, tomorrow morning? He said, yeah. I hadn't planned to spend the night. I hadn't packed anything. I asked him, is there a hotel within walking distance? He said, yes, there's the Fairfield Inn 2 blocks away. And so I walked there to the Fairfield Inn. And when I got there, I remembered my younger brother. In fact, he's now with the Lord. He was a salesman, traveled all the time, had zillions of miles, and he was part of the Marriott membership. And so I called him. I said, Tim, I'm going to save the cash I've got. I don't have much. Can you book me a room on your miles? He said, absolutely, no problem. So I stood in the lobby and waited, and he finally called me back. He said, Stephen, I got the rep for Marriott here, and there's no Fairfield Inn where you are at that address. I said, yeah, I'm standing in the lobby of the Fairfield Inn. He said, well, there isn't any. He said, well, look, you hold on. Let me get the person back on the line. About 5 minutes later, he called me back. He said, Stephen, there is no Fairfield Inn where you're standing. I said, there is too. I said, no, wait a second. I walked outside, looked up at the sign, and it said Fairfield Motor Inn. And I'd noticed that there was no air conditioning in this hotel, and the carpet was old. It was that, you know, you grew up with that shag, red and tan, and everything was kind of chewed up. And I thought, oh my goodness, well, he said, Stephen, if you can get just 10 miles north of you to New Haven, I got a free room for you, continental breakfast. Will be paid for, of course. You can stuff your pockets with apples and oranges and make it through. I didn't know why any of this was happening. Didn't like it at all. I said, okay. I asked the hotel clerk if she would call me a cab. And she did. I got in the cab and I said, I want to go to Fairfield Inn, a real one, in New Haven. He said, okay, that's 20 miles north. It's going to cost you $30. I said, no, it's 10 miles north. It'll cost me 15. He said, no, it's 20 miles north. It'll cost you 30. I got out of the cab, you know, pronounced blessings upon him. Walked back into the lobby, and I asked the lady, call me an honest, not one of your friends, call me an honest taxi. He told me that it's 20 miles away. She said, let me show you a map. It is, as he was driving away. Now what do I do? It's now nearly 7 o'clock at night. This is a long story. Do you want me to finish it? It's taken a while. I called the dealership. I got the only salesman that was left there, and I explained, I needed to get to New Haven. Would he be willing to take me? He said, you know, I'm going to be here till 8, and that's an hour round trip for me. And I'm sorry, I just can't do it. I said, I understand. I really did. I probably wouldn't have done it either. And we hung up. What do I do? I don't have much cash. I'm hungry. Those donuts have worn off hours earlier. My cell phone is running out of battery. My van is a lemon. And I'm stuck in a town in Connecticut, no doubt, filled with liberal Democrats. Named after a cat. I mean, this cannot get worse. What is going on? I was about to call another taxi, and the lady at the desk said, sir, you have a call. I went to the phone, and it was the salesman. He said, listen, I've been thinking about you, and I realize you're stranded, and I feel terrible. Tell you what I'll do. If you can help me with a little gas money, I'll take you to New Haven. And I said, thank you so much. A little after 8 o'clock, he pulled up in his car. We took off. His name was Michael. He was in his early 70s, retired, but he had started working a little bit, selling again to make a little money. You know, we had a little chit-chat, a back and forth. I told him the story about, you know, the Fairfield Inn thing. He thought that was funny, and by that time, I'm chuckling a little bit too. Not much. At this point, he didn't know I was a pastor or a Christian, which was good. I didn't really want to act like one anyway, so we're driving along, and And all of a sudden, he just kind of starts telling me his story. He's a quiet man, which was good, but he's telling me his story now. And he begins to be rather talkative. He'd been in the military. In fact, he'd even been captured. I found that intriguing. He spent time as a prisoner of war. After getting out of the military, he'd married, but had divorced years earlier and hardly ever saw his two grown children and their families. He told me he'd gotten cancer a year or so ago, nearly died, but survived of the treatment. Then moved to Fairfield to be near his high school sweetheart, who was now a widow. And he said in a rather hushed tone that he had undergone a number of blood transfusions during his cancer treatment and as a result had contracted HIV. By the time they discovered it, it was full-blown. He had been told less than a few weeks before our visit together in that car that he had been given less than 6 months to live. I thought, here I am complaining about a broken down van, and this man has had a reversal in his life like I can't imagine. He looked at me and he said, you know, I have never told anyone, that I have AIDS. But then again, you're not from around here. He said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to gather up just enough money and I'm going to move to Florida. And I'm going to die in the sun. I'll never forget that. I'm going to die in the sun. No doubt in my mind that every reversal of the last few weeks had been orchestrated by God so that I would be brought to a town in Connecticut to hear a story a man had never told anybody who was dying. We sat out in the parking lot of the Fairfield Inn, the real one, in New Haven. And after a while, Michael bowed his head and put his faith into words as he trusted in Jesus Christ alone. We kept in touch periodically until months later when he did indeed die. He never made it to Florida. He didn't die in the sun. But he died in the sun. S-O-N. In the embrace of his Lord and Savior. Now, I was late in spotting this truth, modeled by the Apostle Paul. A change of circumstances, a set of them that seemed to be taking me in reverse, was God's way of making forward progress. It took me to Fairfield, Connecticut. It took Michael to heaven. The maturing believer is one, and this is so convicting to all of us, who learns to spot early on, to interpret the reversals in life as part of God's ultimate curriculum, so that we end up not necessarily getting everything we want or think we need, but we end up where he wants us and he receives glory and our deeper trust. In the little book that I've been reading from on Sunday evenings called The Valley of Vision, a collection of prayers, I want to close with reading one of them. And here is this reversed thinking of deep and great maturity. Lord, thou hast brought me to the valley of vision, the valley of vision, where I live in the depths but see thee in the heights. Hemmed in by mountains of sin, I behold thy glory. Lord, let me learn that the way down is the way up, that to be low is to be high, that the broken heart is the healed heart, that the contrite spirit is the rejoicing spirit, that the repenting soul is the victorious soul, that to have nothing is to possess everything, that to give is to receive, that to bear the cross is to wear a crown, that the valley is a place of vision. Lord, in the daytime, stars can be seen from deepest wells. And the deeper the well, the brighter thy stars shine. So let me find thy light in my darkness, thy life in my death, thy riches in my poverty, thy joy in my sorrow, thy grace in my sin, and thy glory in my valley.